And thank you for joining us on another edition of the Scholars Podcast, Conversations with Inspiring Leaders. Today, I'm privileged to host Dr. Jackie Baker, an expert on all things Indonesia. From her formative years in Darwin to the hallowed halls of ANU in Canberra, the London School of Economics, and now Murdoch University, Jackie's academic odyssey has been marked by a strong commitment to understanding and engaging with Indonesia's multifaceted reality. Jackie, welcome to the program.
Thank you for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here.
Your academic career is inspiring to many. It's been shaped by a very real connection to Indonesia. Could we begin today by you sharing with us perhaps a pivotal moment or an experience that ignited your passion for Indonesian studies?
Well, I kind of came at it in a circular way, in that I wasn't in any way interested in studying Indonesia. I didn't know much about Indonesia when I started my degree at the ANU. But what I really wanted to study was Malaysia, which is my mother's background. But there was no Malaysian studies and there was not a lot of people there. So I sort of rolled into Indonesian studies, knowing that the languages were similar. But this was around 1997, and in the summer holidays, some friends and I from our Indonesian class went backpacking from Bali to Kupang. And this was in the summer of 1997, turning 1998. And for those familiar with Southeast Asian history, 1998 was a formative year for Indonesia. This was the year that the 32-year-long dictatorship of Suharto was overthrown in a social revolution for democracy in Indonesia. So what we went on a backpacking trip to Bali and Lombok and what have you, expecting to, you know, just pick up a bit of language and have a bit of fun. And we were thrust into the heady world of Indonesian politics really fast. The rupiah was dropping at a pace. People were starving. The military were patrolling the streets. Some places we went to, there were military planes flying overhead. There was a palpable sense of fear and anger, sometimes towards us. But at night, when things calmed down a little bit, I recall sitting with kind of the hostel owner's son while he sang songs on his guitar for revolution. And so there was this bubbling feeling that in amidst the chaos and the fear, there was hope and aspiration. And indeed, five months later, the unthinkable happened and Suharto fell. So it's this kind of heady politics of democratization, social revolution, popular social movements. I mean, how could you not fall in love with a country like that at that point in time?
And what a great time to be there, Jackie.
Yeah. Yeah. It was seminal. Yeah. It was formative in my life.
How many times have you, I know you're in WA now, you're based in Perth. How many times have you been to Indonesia?
Oh, hundreds.
Really? Wow.
I lived there for a big chunk of my 20s. In fact, if anything, from my 20s to my mid-30s, Jakarta was my home. And I often feel like, you know, that's a pretty important time of your life as well. And that was where I kind of came of age, I guess, became a grown-up, was in this crazy city of, you know, somewhere in the vicinity of 10 million people. So I lived there for quite a chunk of my life, working in international development. And now I go back probably a few times a year at least, for research purposes, engagement purposes, all sorts of things. So it's a big part of my life, and a lot of my life decisions are around, can I get to Indonesia? When can I get to Indonesia?
Got to get back up there.
Got to get back up there, exactly.
So your career path, Jackie, has taken you through various roles, from researcher, as you mentioned, to lecturer. How do you navigate the intersection then between academia and practical engagement, particularly covering Indonesian society and looking at the political environment up there?
That's an incredibly important question and a very difficult question to answer, because we all want to work with integrity and with truth. And sometimes the nature of engagement means we need to be a little more diplomatic. And we need to negotiate our way through.
Are we normally diplomatic in Australia? I don't know.
We're much too diplomatic sometimes, frankly. I think there is an absolutely a slippery path to negotiate between engagement and kind of the pure ivory halls of academia, wherein your critique doesn't have immediate consequences for relationships and for what's getting done. And I think if there's one thing that I think that has defined my career, it has been an interest in pursuing the tensions, the contradictions of work, the contradictions, these kinds of ethical tensions, I think are inherent to leading a good and engaged life. So there are times where I engage. There are times where I pull back. There are times when that engagement is no longer productive and you can need to find a different strategy in order to engage. And that can be, ivory tower critique. Scholars in thinking about impact need to negotiate those paths and see that tension as fundamentally productive, and always see it as a kind of ethical gauntlet being thrown down.
Well said. Teaching politics must offer, you've touched on this already, unique insights, challenges, and the like. So what strategies do you employ to ensure a deeper understanding of the intricacies of governance in Indonesia for your students?
Oh, that's another great question. I think if anything, it's incredibly difficult to talk about Indonesia and Australia. It's incredibly difficult, and it's becoming more and more difficult. If you just read it from language engagement alone, from Australian students studying Indonesian at the primary school, high school, and university level, it has never been as low as it is today. It's also never been as cheap.
Really?
Yeah. So Australians are running from language in droves.
Why is that?
Well, they're running from the language in general, and I think there's a sense that, oh, with English, I can operate everywhere, which is a mistake, an absolute mistake, because, yes, you can absolutely operate everywhere with English, but you will operate in certain kinds of bubbles and have certain kinds of realities reinforced to you, and you'll never be able to see outside that bubble. And so in some ways, it's a very dangerous path to take. But that's a problem across the board. Indonesia specifically has problems in that I think for Australians, it's thought of as messy, as chaotic, as deeply corrupt. Its democratization process has not been smooth. And when Australian academics have talked about Indonesian politics, it really is quite off-putting, I think, for Australians. You know, because we're here, we're critiquing, there's this problem, there's that problem, there's this problem. And I think the Australians go, it's just too messy. Why would we bother with this place?
Too hard.
This place is a basket case. Don't bother. You know, add that to numerous terrorist attacks, you know, some mishandlings of terrorist imprisonment by the police and the judiciary, the general static that's in the relationship. And I think I don't think our relationship is as good as it could be, especially because Indonesia is an amazing archipelago. It's a really exciting place. It's an incredible place. And I kind of liken it to the US, actually, if anything. You know, and the US is sort of feels like every political spectrum has made its mark, from the far left to the far right. What I love about Indonesia is it has the capacity to dream up radical political visions in a way that, you know, would never happen in our staid, kind of sterile democratic politics in a two-party system in Australia, right? And I find that incredible. I find that unendingly fascinating. And I wish Australians would join me in that curiosity for believing in other political worlds, you know, other things are possible.
The miracle of Indonesia. So we've just had an election up there. I'm keen on your observations, Jackie, on the outcome and what it means in particular for the Australian-Indonesian relationship, certainly in the near term.
Well, the election has been much discussed because this election in some ways marks some kind of turning point, but we're not quite sure what kind of turning point. I mean, on paper, it was an incredible success. Indonesia holds the largest simultaneous national election in the world. And by simultaneous, we mean the Indonesians, 204 million people went and elected a president, a regional council, a national legislature, their local legislatures. So there were five different kind of ballots on the bill, right? And you're doing all of those elections all at the same time. And it happens without terrible conflict, without people shooting each other. You know, it's a relatively peaceful and integral process. It's free. It's relatively free and fair. And I think it's quite a miracle, actually. It's a logistical, you can imagine just the logistics of getting.
I can't imagine it. How do they do it?
Something in the vicinity of 30,000 different ballots need to get across that archipelago in time for that election, for it all to happen.
That's a big sausage sizzle, Jackie.
Yeah, that's it's an incredible logistical exercise. And yet they pull it off every 5 years. So in some ways, you know, Indonesian democracy needs to be seen as the success that it is. However, this time round, a president, a very controversial president has been elected, which has overshadowed the success of Indonesia's sixth national election since the fall of Suharto. And this individual is very much tied into that old authoritarian regime. He himself is the son-in-law of Suharto, married into the family. He's a blue blood, an aristocrat, who worked his way up to the top of the most fearsome units within the army, which in itself was a very fearsome political player under the new order, and backed up Suharto and was the sort of basis of his coercive power. So you've got a person whose career was forged under the new order and who believed, I think the seed of his belief that he would become president started way back then, you know, and a person born into absolute privilege and made it to the top of his game in every way. He himself has argued that Indonesia shouldn't really be a democracy, that the adversarial qualities of democracy is too much for Indonesia. And he would like to see Indonesia return to a system that is much more like Suharto. So this is the kind of individual that has been voted in, resoundingly voted in. He won the presidential election on 57%. And his competitors, Anies Baswedan and Ganjar Pranowo, only received somewhere in the vicinity of 20%, give or take. So a resounding win for General Prabowo Subianto. And a lot of that win has come about because the former president, Joko Widodo, who had, you know, famously very good relationships with the likes of Malcolm Turnbull, he's a furniture seller from a small town in central Java. Both, you know, self-made man, entrepreneur, made his way up from local mayor to president. And he was very keen to see his legacy shored up. He had very high popularity polling, and he had a cache of voters, so somewhere in the vicinity of 10 to 15%, who would follow his endorsement. And it was Jokowi's endorsement for Prabowo Subianto that ultimately has won this kind of authoritarian populist, the prime seat in Indonesian politics.
So a follow-up to that would be, let's presume for a moment, Jackie, you are working in the Prime Minister's office. You're the Indonesian policy advisor. What are you telling the PM about the new leader of Indonesia and how best to play the relationship for Australia's interests?
Most certainly, Australia will be saying our relationship is deeper than any president, right? Our relationship and they'll be right, frankly. Our relationship extends through alumni ties, through deep people-to-people ties. We have many different facets of the relationship, and that this election will not impede that. You know, many people are pursuing common interests with Indonesia around certain kinds of projects, around certain kinds of business projects, private sector interests, public sector interests, universities, what have you. That work will proceed unimpeded. And in part they'll be right. However, I think that Australia needs to support Indonesia's determination and the determination of the Indonesian people to be a democracy, Indonesians love democracy. They love voting. They turn up at like 80%. Even their local elections, they're turning up at 65%. My local council in Fremantle is like 29%. You've got all of half of the population, if more, turning up routinely for elections. They love elections. We need to support Indonesia's the profound love that Indonesians have for voting. And we also need to support Indonesia's, and I believe their deep-seated belief in rights and in human rights. And I think that when there is a tussle between maintaining diplomatic relations and those values, I think we need to think that through very carefully, because while the government of the day may be pushing in one direction, the people of Indonesia have made themselves very clear. And I think that the people of Indonesia, with whom we have those people-to-people relations, will be looking to us for support should there be further democratic rollback.
Jackie, could you shed some light perhaps on a recent project or a finding that you believe holds particular relevance or significance in the current political landscape of Indonesia?
Yeah, I work on a couple of different projects. One project that I think may be of particular interest to Australians and is funded through a DFAT project called Connexi or Connections is a multidisciplinary consortium working on climate change, issues of climate change in Indonesia. So Indonesia, 17,000 islands, is on the front lines of climate change. We know that Southeast Asia is going to be disproportionately affected by climate change. And in the communities that we have been working for many decades, the issue of climate change became increasingly visible. And it became, we were working on issues of political empowerment, on urban communities, all sorts of issues. And slowly, you notice agricultural yields are falling and people are getting out of the land, or people are moving away from fishing where they usually did, or your community is being devastated by tidal flooding every couple of years. And so as a political scientist, obviously I'm interested in climate change, but I didn't see it as necessarily a part of my research remit. But climate change came to us, right? And so it really called upon us to build a collective of academics working across disciplines to respond. So we're working at the moment with a number of communities to map and quantify the irreversible effects of climate change on their lives. And we're talking about health, we're talking about livelihoods, we're talking about infrastructure that is being devastated. And you can see it's so visible in some of these places. For instance, our coastal community, just walk around the little alleyways of the village, and it's a very poor, these are all poor, marginalized communities. And there'll be just a house that's kind of semi-underwater, you know? Like, imagine on your street, there's sort of three houses that just seem to have been waterlogged, you know? So you've got it. It's very visible. It's very tangible. And we're working with communities to quantify the effects of climate change on their lives and to look to the new Loss and Damages Fund, which was established in the COP28 in November last year, in order to apply for money for climate reparations, in order to aid these communities to move, should they decide to, or to respond in other ways to the irreversible effects of climate change. It's worth noting that the Loss and Damages Fund was established because Western countries who have historically produced the emissions are not experiencing the effects of climate change at the same speed and rate that developing countries who are less able to adapt and who have not contributed to historical emissions. And so this fund exists as a way of as a form of restorative justice in order to aid communities to respond to climate change. So they are not just victims of this fast-moving dynamic.
So you've mentioned climate change. It's obviously one of the biggest issues facing Indonesia. How then can academia, broadly speaking, contribute to helping to address these big challenges such as climate change?
So my core position as a political scientist is that climate change is less a meteorological problem than it is a political problem, right? It is about disparities in power. Just as I said earlier about why is it that the developing world is the one bearing the brunt of climate change when they did not produce the emissions for climate change? Why is it that we have not responded to the calls for to end fossil fuels? Why is it that with all the different technologies that we have to transition away from fossil fuels, we don't? Right? These are all political problems. They're not technology problems, not data problems, they're not knowledge problems. So our position in this climate change project is to bring a whole range of different disciplines together, whether it be public health or engineering, climate scientists, obviously, and to get them to do their very important work of mapping, mapping both qualitatively and quantitatively the effects of climate change, but understanding that whatever you produce, whether it be an academic finding, it in and of itself doesn't do anything, right? We can have all the data in the world. We've known since the 80s, right, that climate change was an existential threat to civilization. It's a political problem. So to me, it falls to the political scientists to think about the strategies and the ways that you can get leverage around these issues. And to me, that's about rebalancing the existing balance of power. That means the people who are most affected need to be aided and empowered in order to have voice. And that is about, well, that's a whole series of different strategies, a whole different set of questions. But again, climate change is first and foremost a political problem.
And it's a political problem here in Australia too. The major parties can't seem to agree on anything when it comes to climate change. Prime ministers have risen and fallen off the back of climate change. So I don't think it's an Indonesian problem. It's a global problem, certainly one we're facing in Australia.
That's absolutely right. And I think one thing that has been incredibly disappointing to see as an Australian citizen who works in collaboration with Indonesian academics is to see Australia's performance at COP28, which was to routinely undermine the establishment of a loss and damages fund, and to do it in ways make proposals that diverted from the voices of the developing world, and particularly from the small island nations that had really put this proposal up and had fought for it for 10 long years. So regardless of changes in government, and even if we had a climate change election, our last election, the general position of the Australian government has been to lump in with the fossil fuel producing countries and undermine multilateral efforts for restorative justice around climate change.
If you look at Indonesian studies, it's obviously an evolving area. Are there any trends you're seeing, Jackie, anything that's emerging in your research that you find particularly promising or deserving of greater attention?
I think it's precisely the emergence of these transnational and interdisciplinary teams that we're seeing across the world. The nature of grant funding has always been very, very tight. But what grantors are looking for increasingly are interdisciplinary, international, transnational teams that can address really big questions. And that's on climate change, but all sorts of things. So I think that's really drastically and dramatically transforming academia, which has always operated in disciplinary silos, and for good reason, and there's a necessary reason to have disciplinary silos. But it is also an incredibly exciting practice to start to learn from other disciplines and to try to work together and work collaboratively together. So I think that that is most certainly the way forward for academia and to address the big problems that we have, whether they be problems of inequality, of stagnating growth, of climate change, of intergenerational injustice. These are all going to be issues that are going to be come out through interdisciplinary transnational teams. And so I think there's an amazing and exciting learning curve ahead for us. And ways of doing things that are going to be completely different. And I'm really glad to be here and be part of that.
We're glad to have you here. given your extensive experience in this area, could you offer up any advice to other academic scholars who are perhaps embarking on research endeavours across Southeast Asia, particularly those with a focus on Indonesia? Do you have any advice for them?
You know, sometimes I think about Indonesia and my life in Indonesia as like an alter ego. In Australia, I'm anxious and dorky and very law-abiding. And then when I get over to Indonesia, you know, wild semi-Indonesian Jackie emerges.
You get your crazy on.
I get my crazy on. And that's because I find that the country offers me so much. You know, it offers me so much. It offers me a way to reflect in ways that I just never imagined, you know. And that can be across the whole gamut, right? Like, I mean, I've hung out with jihadists and run studying jihadists who are running a jihadic war, a religious
really?
War. Oh, my God. I've
Your
hung
idea.
Out with police, with gangs, but also with a lot of civil society, with communities advocating for their rights, you know, who people who have primary school education facing off against some of the most powerful people in the country and saying that is not right. Advice for anyone studying Indonesia, I guess throw yourself in, you know, get your alter ego on and throw yourself into this amazing place.
Embrace it, yes.
Embrace it. It offers so much potential for growth and insight and reflection. I dedicate everything I write to Indonesia and to Indonesians for just lifting me out of what is a very sterile middle-class life into a world where I can see a kaleidoscope of perspectives and experiences. And I'm just incredibly grateful to Indonesia for that. So let your gratitude and your curiosity lead you, I guess, through your research.
The wonderful thing about Indonesia, I find, is it's on our doorstep. It's not far away. It's a short flight, particularly for you in WA. And then it's just this other world. You land at the airport and it's like, wow, how long has this been here? What's going on? This is crazy.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And Indonesia has a very, you know, tormented and very sad history in some ways. And yet Indonesians themselves are incredibly generous. They're incredibly hospitable. You know, they have a sense of how to treat guests and how to treat people. I've never felt unsafe in Indonesia in ways that I have perhaps in Europe and other places. So I do find it to be a place that has seen great tragedy and yet tries to always hold its head high.
So if you were to look ahead, Jackie, what are some of the, you might not have thought about this, what are some of the goals or the projects that you hope to pursue or finish off in the coming years?
Well, I'm definitely going to continue to pursue climate change. That's my big agenda, to look at how climate change is affecting communities and the multifaceted ways, and to try to build this consortium into a community of academic practice that can operate across different and talk across different disciplinary lines in order to empower communities for their rights, right? For their reparations. You know, you're looking at hundreds of millions of people across the sea whose lives are going to be dramatically affected by climate change. No water, inundated by water, no agricultural yields, food security. You know, I hate talking about this as a security threat for Australia, but these are our neighbours, and we have produced a lot of emissions over the years. They don't enjoy the standard of life that we do. And, you know, I believe that we owe it to our neighbours to help them assert their democratic rights in a very scary context of climate change. And so we need to, and I think through that process, we'll also learn something as well for our communities that will be inundated by climate change and how democracy can aid people to assert their rights, right? What are we going to do? How's local government going to respond, right? How's provincial government going to respond? Are we going to have a disaster relief? How are we going to pay people out if they can't live in a place anymore? I mean, places like Lismore are just grappling with these issues, right? And so is Java. So is South Thousand Island. So are parts of Eastern Indonesia. We can learn together on this. So for me, that's one really big project. I also continue to work on Indonesian politics, which, again, as I've said, is central to the project of acting on climate change. I particularly work on Indonesian police and the Indonesian police as a political actor within the political system. And that has brought me into dialogue with wider critiques of the sort of rise of an international movement, rethinking the role of police in the wake of Black Lives Matter. And that Indigenous people actually that have long discussed, debated, and thought of strategies around. So bringing together a community of knowledge around policing that has new visions for policing that would draw Indigenous Australian movements, abolitionist movements into dialogue with Indonesian police reformers, that's also a big project I have.
Dr. Jackie Baker, 2004 John Monash Scholar, one of the originals, the first cohort of scholars.
Well, I got in before the standards rose.
There you go.
That's what I like to say. Ducked in before the bar got higher.
An OG scholar. Jackie, thank you for coming on to our podcast. It's been wonderful hearing from you today. Terrific insights on all things Indonesia. And we wish you well with your future studies and research. So thank you and good luck.
Thank you, Justin.